I'm Kirsten Garrett, the executive producer of Radio National's investigative program, Background Briefing, and I'm with you today on Big Ideas for the 11th annual Manning Clark Lecture with former ABC journalist Chris Masters. Now, he's arguably one of Australia's best investigative reporters. From 1983 to 2008, he made over 100 reports for one of our flagship television programs, Four Corners. Some of them were literally nation-changing, like 1983's The Big League, which triggered the Street Royal Commission, and French Connections in 1985 about the sinking of the Greenpeace ship, the Rainbow Warrior. His most famous report was The Moonlight State. It investigated police corruption in Queensland, which initiated the Fitzgerald Inquiry and led to a raft of reforms that reached well beyond the state of Queensland. Other reports have included The Dead Heart, Inside a Holocaust, and The Coward's War. Chris Masters has also written three books, Inside Story, Not for Publication, and Jonestown. He left the ABC in 2008 and now teaches investigative journalism and film writing, as well as being a contributing editor for the Sydney's Daily Telegraph. The most important round in any news organisation, which doesn't exist in any news organisation, argues Chris Masters, is the round devoted to what has not yet happened. That's how we should be resourcing the industry, to have journalists ready to discover new stories, rather than have news editors picking what they think will sell. From the National Library, with the 11th Annual Manning Clark Lecture, Chris Masters and Investigative Journalism.
I'm very honoured to be asked to do this and flattered to see so many people turn up tonight. It obviously pays to be dead. My talk is, after all, about a career post-mortem. So thanks for being here. And to the Clark family for the honour and my acknowledgement to the traditional owners and respect to elders past and present of all tribes that converge on this meeting place. Professor Clark remains a grand figure in this nation. We never spoke, but I do recall nodding to him at the shops near here at Manuka and recognising the grand moment that I was in the presence of someone whose name and ideas would be familiar to my grandchildren. A great teacher such as Manning Clark would advise me to speak of what I know. This, as you know, is counsel journalists don't often keep. I am from an industry of low regard, an industry in decline. I've long thought the main reason journalists poll so poorly on the reputation index is because of a widespread belief we appropriate the public's stories and reprocess them, first of all, for our own benefit. The public can attend and even enjoy the spectacle, but that does not mean they will accord value and respect. I'll shock you a little with a bold confession and admit that I like and, for the most part, admire journalists. I'll further go where journalists are often told not to tread and challenge public opinion. Most journalists I see at work every day put public interest before personal gain. Most journalists I see at work every day are there because it's a vocation and not a job. Most become hardened to the reality that if we do our job properly, our subjects will never approve of what we say. We attend to what the American author and journalist James Agee described as the effort to perceive simply the cruel radiance of what is. It's the best phrase I've ever heard to describe journalism. The effort to perceive simply the cruel radiance of what is. We know more than most that no one owns these stories, nor do we have and should we have power over our own reputation. So we live with the opprobrium, but the time has come, I feel, to sell ourselves just a little. I'm not going to talk so much about the politics of journalism as the psychology of the mind of the industry and leak something of the internal dialogue that goes on between journalists all the time at the moment. I was always attracted more to storytelling that eschewed the soap opera and skirmishes for power and attended more to the classic question, why? What happened is important, but for me, why it happened was always the more intriguing challenge. We have trouble explaining the worth of what we do because so much of it is hidden in the abstract. Over a lot of years of looking into people's eyes, you do get better at working out what is important, how to locate the truth, how to form the narrative, and how to make it interesting. It's sometimes said that there are some journalists who have a talent for truth, and you can backmark their work and see, gosh, it's amazing how often they got it right. And the famous American journalist, help me out here, they made a movie about him. Ed Murrow, greatly admired by me, of course, so much so that I mislocate his name, but it's actually true. But, you know, when you look back at his body of work, it was amazing how many times he was in the right place at the right time, how many great reports he did, really challenging reports, how he confronted public opinion over civil rights in the United States, and, of course, the famous McCarthy stuff. But I do know his work very well, and I don't, frankly, think that television actually has got a lot better since those days of his documentaries back in the 1950s. But I don't think it was a talent for truth. I think it was about process. I think he knew how to hunt truth out. I think he worked very, very hard at it. A good colleague of mine in at the ABC, Andrew Ollie, had in local terms a very similar career. And I think, and I know this because I worked closely with Andrew, it was much the same with him. But the most influential journalist in my life is my own mother, Olga Masters, a great reporter, content to work in the provincial press, and whose words continue to be translated into Russian, Italian, and the like. She would say the best stories are found in the human heart, and I'm sure she was saying not only in the heart of the subject, but in the heart of the storyteller. Some reporters operate to the good get principle, that is, they see the game as largely driven by luck. If you wait long enough, you'll be there at the right time when the phone rings, and 6 months later, you'll mount the steps to receive that award. There is an argument that the internet now delivers the opportunity to democratise news gathering so that editors and reporters are no longer needed to make that judgment about what the public can know. You can tell a lot about a reporter in the way they go about selecting a subject. Do you pick the story that puts you centre stage, that tells itself, or do you take on something that might hurt a bit, but somewhere in the future assist public enlightenment? The best approach I found over many, many years of thinking about this was pretty much the lawyer's cab off the rank system, which gives chance, fortune, the choice. Of course, you know, you have to make a basic selection that passed a basic test of it being important, it being newsworthy. There are practical considerations about whether you have the time and resources to give it a go. And then you have this fight with yourself about proceeding, because you kind of know that if you're doing a story that is important and in the public interest more than it's in your personal interest, then there'll be a lot of pain along the way. So you have to resist all those excuses that you can easily adopt to say, no, I can't do this story. And I think that's what happens too often in newsrooms. I think there's an enormous amount of self-censorship. I think too often we say to ourselves, and I've said it to myself, I'm going to duck this one. Mind you, I've said it to myself often for good reasons, because I was going through my death by a thousand courts and I simply couldn't afford to get back into court. The value of the approach is that we are more likely steered on a course of public interest. At first, it might be, and it probably will be difficult, as you work your way through the conventional 48 hours news cycle. You make the same phone calls as everyone else, and you get the same knockbacks. But then after time, as I so often found, you are into no man's land, negotiating carefully a path connecting public interest with what the public find interesting, and soon you are in new territory and the story begins to come alive. The work can be exciting. It's mostly not. It's mostly mundane, and I think it's mostly important to do the mundane stuff, and that will be presented to you if you do this cab off the rank approach. But the value of the mundane stuff is it actually teaches you a lot about the craft. What I think is most exciting about the news business is its unpredictability. I think about the time in 1985 when my editor said to me, "This ship has been blown up in Auckland Harbour. Why don't you go over and have a look at it?" And I think now, I can't imagine a news editor making that judgment now. You know, they're so risk averse, and it frankly was an extraordinary risk. Nobody had any idea that the French Secret Service might have been behind that bombing, but it was a fabulous piece of news judgment by somebody who just had a sense that this was important. And it was one of those rare occasions when a reporter is caught up in a real-life spy thriller, and we chased the bombers all over the globe from New Zealand through to the Pacific Islands and back to France, by which time the story had really taken off. People were getting a sense that the French Secret Service might have been behind it. We readied the program. We were about to put it to air. The French Secret Service on that very night on the ABC News Bulletin announced that the government had nothing to do with it, and then we broadcast this program that showed demonstrably that they were actively engaged, and the program sold right around the world. I can't say there were too many experiences like that, but it's great to know that they can happen, and I wish our editors would take a few more risks. Because I think the most important round in any news organisation that does not, as far as I know, exist in any news organisation is the round devoted to what has not yet happened. And that's how we should be resourcing the industry, to have journalists ready to discover the facts rather than have news editors telling you what they want to know and, you know, practicing anniversary journalism and all that other predictable stuff. The best stuff we do is when we don't just surprise the public, but we surprise ourselves. I often say to young reporters, take on the jobs that advance your skills ahead of the jobs that advance your profile. Just as opinions are dangerous without an underpinning of fact, the spotlight is an equal hazard. If you have nothing to say, then you can look pretty stupid pretty quickly. And if you look at television, you see people being cast in all the time for their winning smile, but they don't realise that unless they produce the body of work, they'll be cast out just as quickly. The skills you develop along the way make every story you choose that much better. Patience will be required. These are skills that are not summoned via Google. Another virtue of the full immersion principle is it makes your work not just richer in content, but fairer. Professor Manning Clark was better than a good researcher, and like every good teacher, lawyer, politician, and so on, he knew how to form the narrative, how to tell the story. I think you do it by getting out there, by doing it a lot, by doing those mundane stories, by asking everyone you can find, by looking beyond the words to the way people live and behave. This is not work best practiced in an office or forever before the computer. Our job is to put material on the net rather than take it off the net. When you become more confident about narrative, you are less inclined to sideline competing information. You are not so frightened of complexity. Indeed, you may welcome the thickened weave of the story. When the media criticises government for failing to communicate complex policy such as the emissions trading scheme, you might wonder why the media does not spare a little criticism for itself. I thought it was our job to tell the story, and I wonder why people remain so mystified about this. I can think of no more conspicuous failure of contemporary media than in the treatment of global warming. Time again, you see the objective is to cast heat rather than light. It is another subject that is to be exploited rather than explained. When you do a lot of years at Four Corners, you recognise the world is complicated. The World Wide Web helps us access news from former forbidden territory and advances the public an opportunity to bypass the gatekeeper so that the public can try to work it out for themselves. I'm not sure many are keen to do so. In the United States, there's recognition among my colleagues of the need for what they call explanatory journalism. I often found at Four Corners that if we got in quickly and we used the 45 minutes or an hour to deal with a complex subject, it seemed to have the impact of not just educating us and helping to educate the nation, but helping to educate other media. And I'm not being insulting to other media. Nobody else has that time to deal with a subject and to do that amount of research, which is really dumb. It emerges as reporters who are every day asked to do more with less begin the surrender of a sacred objective, the telling of the story. Reporters remain busy, even busier these days, as they assemble for picture opportunities, hunt for headlines, and collect quotes. By my observation, not many see there is the time to explain because there is not the time to research. Yet good research is at the heart of every good story. When I look back on a program I made in 1987 at the Moonlight State, which helped a serious reform of policing around the nation and obviously helped transform Queensland, I can see many elements contributing to what ultimately made a difference. A lot of it was serendipity. A lot of it was luck. A lot of it was because Bjelke Petersen was losing his grasp of power. But still, there was some good journalism there too. And there's nothing like a fact. In this case, it was revealed through one document, a record of a property transaction that linked the criminal cartel to the police commissioner. In those days, it took weeks to access that document, a property record. In these days, it would take minutes. So it's a little hard to figure why more people aren't doing it, that is, research. While it's certainly no magic cure, far from it, the internet does make it easier. But instead of taking advantage of the web to improve primary research, we more often use it to recycle and more thinly spread the little we know. I can see a strong case for a collaboration of the news industry, most particularly the ABC, with the universities to find a way to drive research back into mainstream journalism. I see a need for a resource centre, that's what I call it, that captures and marshals skills, that shows people how to conduct primary research, that generates web-based tools to assist, that encourages greater and simpler access to public information, because if the institutions fade, we will clearly continue to need institutional support. I'm a little embarrassed to admit how surprised I was after resigning from the ABC at how much I missed basic research tools and more general institutional support. It was suddenly easy to see why investigative reporting needs support and not just the expensive support of legal assistance. When reporters operating independently are paid by the word, there's an immediate disincentive to research. The more phone calls, the less profit. The notion that the internet liberates the citizen journalist to unlock the nation's secrets is certainly challenged by my experience. These stories aren't out there lightly covered like Easter eggs. They are mostly in plain sight. And as I said, it's the figuring that matters more than the finding. So who is doing it? Who is undertaking the work? I've never been ready to kill off investigative journalism. It is still alive on the pages of our newspapers and in programs like Four Corners and Beyond. The big changes are in the mind, in the way the industry thinks. News is much more a business than a public service, if I think about, you know, reflecting on my many years. It started out as a news as it was a public service. You paid the license fees. You were obliged to conduct, to deal with the important stories and not just the interesting stories. If you think of the old Willacy programs, the current affair in his time, etc., they took the business quite seriously, and they would run the important interview of the day, irrespective of whether it would rate or not. But bit by bit by bit, that has changed to a point where focus groups basically determine the content of the program. They measure what they find interesting. That is fed back into the system. It has the impact of eliminating anything that the public might find a bit confronting or abstract or too hard to digest. And as a result, bit by bit, our opportunities to do what the best that we do, which is to confront and surprise the public, is eliminated.
On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, I'm Kirsten Garrett, and you're listening to the 2010 Manning Clark Lecture, Investigative Journalism, with Chris Masters. Good research is at the heart of every good story, he says. There's nothing like a fact. Let's return now to the National Library and Chris Masters.
So news is clearly, over this time, become much more of a business than a public service. And stories are much more like commodities. Television has become the medium of choice, a medium, by the way, that I love. It's mine, you know, and I've always thought that it's a very respectable information medium, and it's clear that it can do a lot of good. Television news, however, like talk radio, has a very poor research base. I think this might be broadcast on the ABC, so I'll say it loudly. There are many ABC news reporters that have gone a long time in a career and never broken a story. And it's not completely their fault. The fact is that a huge amount of production goes into television, so instead of having the time on the phone to do the research, a huge amount of the time instead goes into simply making the program. And you can actually find over time that you're not even making the program at all. You're just simply standing in front of the camera. While it is a good information medium, the dominant personality is more and more the entertainer. As one reporter who covered the Chappelle Corby trial told me, the job is becoming more about event management than reporting. The objective there in Bali was not so much to find out what happened, but to be there when a Corby burst into tears. News editors are not always the first to decide where to send the camera. Media advisors in government and business do more of the stage management. Even the subjects are more like actors. When I worked on Jonestown, my book on media demagoguery on Alan Jones, I saw media minders bypassing the press gallery and heading for the talkback demagogues to cut through with their key message. Now they head for the television studio via makeup in a quest to generate a magic moment when they come across as someone with whom you'd like to share a beer. It's kind of sad sometimes watching it. When I look to see the breaking of the big stories, I see more the hand of government. When I started in investigative journalism in the 1980s, there was no independent commission against corruption, Corruption and Crime Commission, Police Integrity Commission, Crime and Misconduct Commission, Office of Police Integrity, and so on. It was also a time when policing in particular needed a revolution, and governments for too long had looked the other way. All across Australia, influential police officers had torn up their contract with the public and gone to work for the people they were supposed to lock up. It's true. I mean, obviously, it's not true in the majority, but it was too true. They had franchised the drugs trade. They were organising armed hold-ups. In Melbourne, there was a trick that you told the uniformed officer not to go anywhere near the boot of the getaway car because the robbers had thoughtfully left the cut for the armed hold-up squad in the boot. And it was actually even worse than that. They partook of the summary execution of their collaborators when it was time to shut them up. I was walking through Sydney the other day and I ran into Mick Drury, who's a police officer who was shot twice in the chest while he was nursing his toddler in suburban Chatswood. And, you know, this is not Columbia. This is Chatswood in the 80s. And it's hard to talk too much about who was behind that murder, but you can kind of guess. That's when it was clear to me that the system had lost the plot and it needed substantial reform. In 25 years, policing has changed, but we would be silly to imagine corruption has been extinguished. When I look for the big stories now, you will often see they've been broken more often by government agencies. The Wollongong Council bribes affair is one of many examples. It kind of looked like a Four Corners program that wasn't on Four Corners. While I'm hardly complaining about government accepting proper regulatory responsibility, I abhor the thought that this advances an opportunity for journalism to step back. Because after all those years, I did form a view that there was quite a virulent corruption culture in Australia. We can have a kind of Anglo conceit about corruption and see it as belonging to Calabria and Macau and places like that, but pretty good at it here too, although in the old days they were more inclined to be corrupt for a cold beer and a cup of tea. I remember a police officer telling me, describing Australian corruption culture and saying, it's like this, when we pull the bloke over on the side of the road and he gives us his licence and there's a $50 note stuck between the licence and the wallet, it flutters to the ground and the bloke says to the copper, oh, you dropped this. And the copper says, oh, no, I didn't. He says, I'm sure you did. And he says, oh, well, okay. And so he puts it in his pocket and books him anyway. That's Australian corruption culture. And I do give an enormous amount of credit to police, not because I know how hard it is for them to do their job, and it is absolutely true that there have been significant reforms in the last quarter century to a point where in the old days, I mean, even if they were as good and tough as they said they were, most of them were drunk by the afternoon and couldn't get much done. But that's not the case anymore. They're much more inclined to go to the gym or home to their family. But as I said, this is a subject that will never go away. There are some things that really worry me, and one is the massive appetite young Australians have for drugs, and who among those young Australians police them but other young police officers, you know. So there's a point where some of them will say to me that they're very cautious about drawing their weapon because they know they'll be exposed to a drugs test. And I find very, very few of them who will actually stand by drugs policy. I mean, I don't know anybody that believes that it's actually working. And the other thing that really worries me is that whereas police have got so much more skillful at hunting down the big money, the temptations are that much greater. In the old days, they were doing it for a cup of tea and a cold beer. Now there's the opportunity with one phone call to make $1 million just like that, you know, and that's a very difficult temptation. And I think we're starting to see some examples of people succumbing to that temptation. So, great case for a good fourth estate, you know, checking the powers of other estates, because government will continue to look the other way. when I was investigating corruption in the Queensland Police, I came upon the story of an Aboriginal man serving a lengthy sentence for the murder of his girlfriend. The man, Kelvin Condren, had confessed to the murder. The trouble was, so too had another man, after committing another murder in a different jurisdiction. What shocked me most about what was uncovered was how far the cover-up had spread. A great many people in many areas of government knew Condren was innocent, but rather than act on their conscience, chose instead to protect the status quo. It was another example of why you need good journalism. While government was engaged in a cover-up that allowed an innocent man to wither in jail, it is also true, however, that the story came to my attention because of people in the system on a government payroll. That is also the way of it. I continue to shake my head at this. I just don't think it's possible to lock these secrets away. It's a funny system, and thankfully truth is an escape artist. Investigative journalists' most regular sources work in the same system that can be so devoted to keeping these secrets. Getting the power balance right is critical. Reporters have to constantly work at maintaining management rights over information. No matter how many sources you develop over the years, there is no doubt the best resource is your own capacity to judge information. As my contacts book grew, I continued to work bottom up, that is, undertaking the painstaking climb until I found the stronger branches. It was always tempting to try to access the story at a higher level. The danger was you just wouldn't know so much. Reporters can mistakenly believe that when they reach the point where they can speed dial the minister's advisor, that the climbing becomes unnecessary. In my own experience, as sources go, the top-level ones are rarely the best. They will more likely tell you only what they want you to know, and perhaps without you realising it, step by step, leak by leak, a takeover of management rights occurs. Low-level sources might be helpful, but another risk emerges that their knowledge and perspective is limited. Journalists tend to love whistleblowers because they can fast-track important information, but there's a similar risk at play. Over the years, I developed an operating principle of preferring to find the whistleblower rather than have them find me. The best sources by far are the mid-level ones. They are more likely to tell you what their boss would prefer you did not know, and they are more likely to know what they're talking about. And for what it's worth, there are plenty of excellent ones right here in Canberra. There might be a few more of the Godwin Gretsch types too, but for what it's worth, if this nation has a natural home for investigative reporters, it's here. While as an industry, journalism is slow to develop the investigative potential of communications technology by facilitating primary research, rather than so eagerly peering into Lara's shower cubicle, government in turn has embraced technology to a point where the public could begin to worry. Our spies are very good. I had some people, I don't know whether anybody from ASIO is in the audience, but I'll give you a compliment. I was talking to some police the other day and they were telling me how good those ASIO surveillance teams were. They said they couldn't even see them. But the capacity of government to spy on its people, to share intelligence, massive information sharing now going on between a range of agencies. Your telephone records can all be checked without any need for a warrant. And that's hard for journalists, by the way. But that capacity to share intelligence, keep secrets, has grown massively in the last decade. And again, I'm not complaining about government accepting responsibility to match and defeat the skills of suicide bombers, drugs traffickers and money launderers. I worry about an imbalance where the strength of independent reporting fades to a point where no one has the time, the space and the skills to confront the important stories. As I've said, journalists do a very poor job communicating their worth. As an industry, we do our best to resist the habit of government to continue to limit press freedom and prosecute reporters for taking important risks and trying to tell the public what's going on. We do have a strong conflict of interest when it comes to advocating the rights of privacy. We are a quarrelsome lot and often absurdly competitive, but I still maintain my affection. I will make an exception for Piers Ackerman, but... I actually work with him now. That's the thing, though. I do work with him, but the best thing about it is we work for the public. We both work for the public. I'm not sure he thinks that, but I certainly do. And that's true. Like the government, we are supposed to work, first of all, for the public, so that at least should unite us. So does mutual recognition of the power of an important story and the need for that story to be told. We are already quietly uniting in resisting the race to the bottom. Journalists are already keeping news breaks from their editors in order to defy the push for a splash. I know of competitors, once sort of stern rivals on a particular round, who now secretly collaborate in order to give the public something better. We know the rise of commentary is not driven by public demand. Under-researched, over-opinionated columnists are not employed because they are bright and bold. It always annoys me the way they like to think that they're so fearless when, you know, none of them are ever going to get sued for doing serious journalism because there's no such thing as false opinion. It's really easy to pretend to be fearless. They are employed because, even with their high salaries, they are cheaper, far less expensive than investigative journalists who can't so reliably deliver because they live in a real world rather than one of contrived certainty. I've never been convinced they actually believe most of what they say. And when I look to get an indication of the amount of research that's gone into their work, I don't see too much. These pundits do have an influence, perhaps less on the public as their own industry. I'd love to see the outcome analysis that says how many more people read newspapers because of Piers Ackerman or whomever. You know, I've just got my doubts. Might be more. It was a bit like with Alan Jones. You know, Alan Jones, he has a strong radio audience, but still a small audience by SBS standards. And when exposed to a broad cross-section of the public through his appearances on television, they found he was a turn-off, that they had to ultimately take him off because they were doing that research I was telling you about, and there was every indication that more people were turning off than... Well, too many people were turning off rather than turning on. But the worry about these pundits is that they may influence young journalists into losing sight of the true objective of reporting, which is to identify research and tell the story. I worry about the what to think becoming more important than the how to think, that young reporters believe they will be honoured more for original analysis than an ability to uncover a fact. Every day you hear the talk. In 10 years' time, there may be no local daily, no Australian, and a further shrunken one newspaper market. Presumably, we will still have the ABC, but the ABC will not be fortified by weakened competition. With the clear exception of programs like Four Corners, the ABC is not as strong an investigative reporter as print media. So I hope more journalists collaborate to defend good journalism, and I hope the public rallies with us. Thank you.
No matter how many sources you develop over the years, there's no doubt that the best resource is your own capacity to judge information. That was Chris Masters delivering the 11th Annual Manning Clark Lecture from the National Library in Canberra last week. Now there was some time for questions from the floor, and the first one was about courage and how much of it he has shown over the last 25 years. But has he ever felt in physical danger or in danger of being bombarded by so much litigation that he wanted to just give up?
Well, the latter was true. That death by a thousand courts was such that, I felt like I had started as a journalist and somehow my life had turned into this nightmare where I was a professional defendant. And anybody who goes through sustained civil litigation can be driven kind of mad. And I ended up having to find a way psychologically to deal with it. And what I did was I said to myself, look, there's no point in feeling sorry for myself. This is just like a disability that I'll have to live with and accommodate into my life. And that's how I cope with it. I think as far as physical danger goes, the dangers are overstated in Australia. I mean, I know there are students here, and I don't want any of them to think that investigative journalism is frightfully dangerous. I've only been thumped a couple of times, but I've certainly it's been risky when I've travelled. It can be very dangerous. And it's funny. I don't actually think I'm very physically courageous. I can be kind of stubborn about sticking to the task. But I can talk about a couple of occasions where, it has been extremely scary when I've been abroad, and I just have no idea how I'm going to respond. On some occasions, I have been extremely frightened, quaking with fear, and on other occasions, I've been kind of exhilarated, found it was really exciting. They used to talk about, I don't want to equate myself with war heroes, absolutely don't, but I think of what Ashley Eakins would tell me about some of the people that got VCs in the wars who were later cashiered for cowardice. So it seems like courage is something, it's like money in the bank. We've got it sometimes and sometimes we don't.
What are the origins of conscience for Chris Masters and how does he sustain it?
That's a tough question. I think, like a police officer that resists corruption against all sorts of pressure from his colleagues, you do ask yourself, why are they doing that? And today I was in Manning Clark's study and I pulled out a book and I looked at it. I must say, I only thought of this academically. I wasn't seriously contemplating it, but it was such a lovely book and it had his signature in it. And it would have been so easy for me to walk away with it. But I would not think of doing something like that. Well, I suppose I did, didn't I? But, academically. But it's got to come down to upbringing and your own sense of right and wrong that is generated by your parents and the people around you. I don't think morality is something that is easily taught. But for what it's worth, I would like to think we tried a bit harder at teaching it. I talked about policing. One of the things that bothers me about policing even to this day is that they still admire the rogues. They will still talk about police officers who do devious and brutal or awful things, but they're those tough coppers who know how to stand up to crooks, and they will speak about them in admiring tones. So whereas in the Australian Army, for example, there is a powerful degree of pride in being a good soldier. I don't think anybody would be proud of a soldier that behaved that way. So I would like to think that our police forces think about maintenance of character, the importance of maintenance of character in the way our Defence Force does.
Why did Chris leave the ABC?
Well, I turned 60, and I didn't find the work any easier than when I was 30. I hadn't lost any enthusiasm for the work, and I still haven't. But you just get to a point where you've got to be smart and make sure that the work doesn't take charge of you. So I didn't leave the ABC because I was disgruntled over the Jonestown experience. I almost did, but I'm glad I didn't either, because that would have been the wrong thing to do.
He's been very critical of the lack of young investigative journalists. So what do they need to do?
I wasn't targeting younger journalists. I'd be more critical of older journalists who aren't getting out. I think that it's well and good for me to say what we should do, and I recognise that practical reality is often very different. My own sense is that if I come upon a story that needs the time, then I find the time myself. I remove it from the news cycle. I work on it in my own time. I find other people, and I think you will find more and more of this. I think journalists are more and more prepared to collaborate, because I think that there's a wide sense that we can't do it on our own anymore. That's what I would do.
With the rise of online content and the collapse of traditional newspapers, is he optimistic or pessimistic about the future of journalism?
Well, none of us, even though, you know, in popular fiction, you know, you have people predicting outcomes 1, 2, 3, 10 times down the track, none of us have had any idea of being able to predict this revolution, even though it's right on top of us. So I can't pretend that I know, but I know a lot about the experience of the United States, and inevitably, you know, that ends up being our experience. We've been lucky to hang on to a lot of our regional publications, but in the United States they haven't. And what that has meant is that whole important subjects that otherwise would have been covered by those newspapers don't seem to be covered anymore. There are lots and lots of reporters who are out of business, who can't report anymore, and it's interesting to see how many of them want to find ways to report, still value the importance of reporting. My overall view is that, and I said this in the speech, that I just think the power of a story, the importance of a story, the need for that story to be told will never disappear. I think the old model, just like the printing press, you know, revolutionised the industry. The World Wide Web has done the same. It takes a while for us to work through this. Everybody talks about a new model. I don't know when that new model will emerge, but I think ultimately it will emerge, and it will be healthy because of those reasons, because people need good news reporting. What I worry about in the interim is the loss of a lot of skills, which is one reason why I think that resource centre idea is a very good one.
He's previously said that his mother Olga, a journalist and novelist, could walk to the butcher's shop and find 10 stories. How did she do that?
I think that, you know, she really was the storyteller rather than the story. She never put herself at the centre of the story. She was genuinely intrigued by other people and other people's lives. We used to find it embarrassing as a kid, because, you know, we had this phrase, you know, what does your father do? What does your father do? Because when we brought a friend around, my mother would say, what does your father do? And I promise it wasn't a snobby thing at all. She just was determined to find out what was going on. And I think the storyteller in her was such a powerful force that, you know, she was so eager for content. And she more than happily did all those jobs on those regional, provincial publications, did the mundane stuff, never turned a nose up at any story, which is, I think, important for every journalist. And she used to say, my children are my finest books, you know. That was Mum. She was a great storyteller.
And finally, what makes him choose one story over another?
Sometimes you just have to make an estimation about what you're going to achieve in the time frame that you have. You will favour the story that you consider to be most important and most newsworthy. In my case, as I was also saying, I would be inclined sometimes to a fault to try to pick the story that was more difficult, that was more challenging, because that is what I think investigative reporters should do. I mean, that is why I did the Jonestown book. If you work as an investigative reporter, sometimes these stories will confront you, and you somehow know it's your job, it's your duty to do them.
That was Chris Masters speaking on investigative journalism. And this has been a Big Ideas program. And if you'd like to hear it again, you can download it or leave a message by going to our website, abc.net.au/rn/bigideas. I'm Kirsten Garrett, and you can catch Radio National's investigative program Background Briefing on Sunday mornings after the news at 9 and on Tuesday evenings after the news at 7. And you're listening to ABC Radio National.
Hello, Richard Ady here. The most interesting people I find realise they always have more to learn. And you can hear that when Melina Marchetta talks about family and friendship and trauma, or when Mitch Albom inches his way back towards faith, or when Ian Brown tells us about life with his profoundly disabled son. And you can find them all on the website at abc.net.au/rn/lifematters.